You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. In this episode, we have Jacob Forensic, who I encountered through a book that he's written. The book is called Up in the Air: Christianity, Atheism, and the Global Problems of the 21st Century. And with some kind of follow-up conversations with Jacob, learned about the book, his philosophical project that I'll allow him to talk about. But really excited to have you on, Jacob. And can you let the listeners know a little bit about yourself, about the book, and where we're talking to you, where you are right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. It's a true pleasure. And well, yeah, so about the book, to give context, perhaps, is to say where I'm from, and that would also just provide like ground for why I wrote the book. So I'm originally from Slovakia, and I come from a pretty Christian household and upbringing, and mostly out of my own volition. I was curious about these things growing up, and I was fundamentalist. So you're from the States, so you probably know about that more than other places.
Sure.
So I kind of associated with Calvinist reasoning. And so a lot of American philosophers, theologians that influenced me early on. And then later on in my life, towards my early, I guess it was late teens, like early 20s. I'm 24 now, so I'm still quite young. And at about that time, I started kind of realizing that the world is bigger, more grand, and there's just a lot more going on than I expected in my youth, as most people realize. And so I just had kind of a time to reflect. I was living in Oxford at the time, in England. I lived in Portsmouth as well on the South Coast. And at that point, I kind of reflected more on my religion and started reading philosophy more broadly, and came into association with the New Atheists, you know, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins. And at that point, I started realizing, okay, so there's a little more here, but then I still didn't know the depth of the intellectual world of atheism, which recently has been called atheism. And so at that point, I was like, okay, so what else is written about this stuff? And at the time, you know, I'm making a long story short. At the time, I was traveling a bunch. I was seeing stuff. I dropped out of uni. I was studying forensic psychology, actually, in Portsmouth. And so I traveled to Oxford and then went to Slovakia, went to Greece and all these places, was living kind of the dropout kind of lifestyle. And I decided finally to go back to Canada, where I'm originally also from. I'm a dual citizen, raised in Canada for 8 years. And so I came back to Canada and I was like, okay, so what am I going to do? What am I going to study? What am I going to do? And I happened upon a book by Peter Watson, and I credit this book largely to my awakening to the depth of atheism. The book is called The Age of Atheists. And at that point, I realized, okay, so there's a lot going on here. And it's a 600-page volume. And yeah. So at that point, I was like, okay, there's a lot here. And that's kind of where I will get into. So that's kind of a background of my religious leanings up to that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of philosophy, and I might be my knowledge of, you know, Calvinism in particular probably has only come through philosophy or if it's used. If I recall properly, in The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism by Max Weber, he uses Calvinism as a basis, as a stand-in for Protestant thinking and kind of an economic analysis. But Calvinism, of course, with a strong piece of predestination and the concept of the calling for work, would that be accurate, just kind of basic kind of a way of laying it out?
Mm-hmm. Calvinism is associated with a number of schools. So Augustine originally, Paul, and also Aquinas were, they wouldn't call themselves Calvinists. Of course, that came later after John Calvin. But John Calvin wouldn't call himself a Calvinist either. That were his followers. And actually, Calvinism came in response to the Arminian school of thought, which was kind of in juxtaposition to the predestination, as you were saying, teaching of Augustine and most of Christendom, actually, up until that point. And so Calvinists basically just sat down and said, okay, so what do we believe in? And they just said that they believe in the juxtaposition of the Arminian school. And so they came up with the 5 points of Calvinism, which are the tulip, which is total depravity, unconditional love, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints. And so all of those kind of came in as a response to the Arminian school. And so, as you said, predestination based on Romans 9 and a bunch of other verses, Ephesians 2:8, verses in the Bible, passages in the Bible that kind of stress this God's electing of his chosen people, of Israel, of, pagans later on, as Paul was witnessing to pagans. And just kind of, so the doctrines appealed to me. And total depravity as well. It seemed that all of the teachings were in connection to scripture and they were scripturally supported. And then also there was more of an intellectual inclination with the Calvinists, especially the neo-Calvinists of today. So those would include R.C. Sproul, Albert Mohler, Steve Lawson, Matt Chandler, Mark Driscoll, and John Piper, more known ones in American evangelicalism, a number of which have passed away, actually. R.C. Sproul, Ravi Zacharias, J.I. Packer, big Calvinist Christian names have passed away recently. So there was also that. So that is kind of the theological backbone of my youth. Yeah.
Yeah. And thank you. And I want to build a little bit on there too, on what you mentioned about your youth. And as far as for purposes of discussion, Jacob, it's really helpful for me to understand kind of like the narrative form of kind of like your intellectual journey, right? And what you try, what you're doing with your book. And I think a lot of philosophers or theologians and others can understand like living as that journey of learning. But you mentioned a little bit about when you were younger. We ask about what you were like when you were younger, and I know you made a couple comments related to that. But how did you view, I don't know, like things like intellectual matters or philosophy or questioning or creating things? What was your relationship, back then? I mean, did you think about writing a book? Did you think about creating?
I had a number of inspirations when I was young and people I looked up to, among which were C.S. Lewis, Clive Staple Lewis, the famous Christian writer. He wrote Mere Christianity, which was a kind of defense of the faith, a collection of BBC talk radio during the span of World War II, which was then collected into a book. And of course, the Chronicles of Narnia and Screwtape Letters and a number of other influential works. He was the friend of Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, and influenced him actually into writing Lord of the Rings. And this man, I was obsessed with him as a young person in my teens. I loved the Narnia series. I just loved the idea of, as a young person, reading about someone who is from a non-unorthodox background, who was Irish, and to go to Oxford from that background, unlikely circumstances, getting into boarding school, not being good at mathematics, being extremely well versed in philosophy and English literature. Actually, he went to school to originally as a philosophy student and also taught philosophy at the beginning. And then later on, he just became an English don and just an expert in 16th, 17th century English literature, which you can see from his writing. He's so well versed and has references. One of the most well-read people. So I read about C.S. Lewis quite a bit in my youth, and that was also one of the reasons why I moved to Oxford when I was living in Portsmouth, because I was reading a biography on Lewis, and I just told myself, you know what, I'm in England, and why not go to this beautiful, lovely place that I'm reading about? And yeah, so as a young man, you aspire to create, and I was creating stuff at the time. I was doing blogging, and that became quite big of a habit when I started university. I published now 350 blog posts, something over that. And so yeah, so but originally that was my influence for sure. C.S. Lewis, among the other ones, of course, Mark Driscoll, Matt Chandler, John Piper, those really influenced me for my Christian leaning. But then, of course, I abandoned that whilst I was in Oxford, actually. So it was an interesting kind of I moved there because of that, but then in the end, I left it.
Understood. And thank you for that on C.S. Lewis too. In that connection you have to have, you always have that connection to his work. We're gonna dig in a little bit, Jacob, on a couple other of the philosophical points and questions we started to get into. But I wanted to ask, I thought now might be a decent opportunity to ask what, a question I ask in each episode, and in particular about your creative process. And you discussed, some great writers, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, etc. Just so make sure we get it in here, and the big philosophical question is, Jacob, do you have a theory of art, or can you tell us what is art?
Yeah, I've actually thought about this question quite a lot as a guitarist, a drummer, a bass player, a writer as well. And I've always tried to pursue that avenue of life, from early on, playing in worship bands and playing in all sorts of high school bands, and even to more recently, trying to release music and trying to go to studios on my own and do solo projects. And just as a person who appreciates art in general, all sorts of music from, the John Mayer to Dave Matthews to the Snarky Puppy, and even to other metal and all this stuff. I really do appreciate most genres of music, apart from perhaps classical, which I haven't gotten into. But yeah, so as art, a definition, a strict definition, I don't know if I would be able to provide, but I think that art can be quite literally anything that resonates with people, that something that is just that you're unable to describe verbally what it is that you resonate with. So a lot of people, especially now in music, for example, there's a big genre of just music that isn't well recorded. and that isn't trying to be professional and isn't trying to sound really good. And you see, for example, artists such as King Krewal, who, aren't really, they're really good singers, of course, but they try to sing in a different way, not the well-versed way, not the, not by the book. And that really resonates with people, and some people wouldn't call that art. Hip hop wasn't called art. People like Ben Shapiro, for example, would say that hip hop isn't music. And for me, I wouldn't be so quick to discredit something that I personally don't identify with. And so that gets into some epistemic axis philosophy, but with art specifically, I mean, it is really interesting to be able to appreciate music that isn't produced well. And I personally have really liked music that isn't produced well and that doesn't have a lot of voices or influences on it and just has like just one person kind of producing. Or and with it, I think that could get more difficult with something like paintings and the fine arts, because at that point it is sometimes perhaps with postmodern art and post-postmodern art, there's almost, you don't know where the boundary is of, is this good or is this not? But for myself, we do live in, a beautiful time where beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And if art does resonate with certain people, it's always about seeing where is the appreciation coming from. And I think that each era has, the classicists, and the Renaissance and the neoclassicists and the romanticists. Each era of art really has something that they dislike about those who preceded them, and something that they somehow they discredit their work and say that it's not really art and this is more complicated or anything or something like that. But I think that I personally do appreciate the simplicity. And one of my favorite drummers, who played with everyone from, he's played on David Letterman show for years, Steve Jordan, and he's played with pretty much every musician. Even for John Mayer, his trio, for example, he said simplicity is not stupidity. And in music, I mean, that is completely true.
Well, thank you for that answer, Jacob. And it's great to hear about some of your background in music as well. And I appreciate your thoughts, your philosophical thoughts on art and applying it to the work that you do in music. One of the things about your book that I'd love for you to go into a bit more is that obviously with the subject matter in your own personal journey, as far as answering questions, metaphysical questions, is there God? And that's of course relates to something rather than nothing question relates to it. But you have two. You talk about the influence for you in growing up and your thought around Christianity, Calvinism, and some of the writing in fiction and C.S. Lewis that you listen to. And on the other side, you have atheism. And when people think about atheism in the sense of that there isn't a God, and for our casual listeners, agnosticism. Doubting the existence of God. It's obvious to a lot of folks that a lot of the political culture, at least the political culture that's been around in the United States recently over the last few months, and some of the kind of pitched political or ideological conflicts that have arisen. What about your book and the way that you structure it? Do you think can help in discussion, in philosophical discussion about, what might be perceived to be opposites, Christianity, atheism, various belief system, and what others view to be a contradictory belief system? What do you think your book does to help folks chat and philosophize and maybe chat like you or I might right now?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, I think that this is particularly what I wanted to achieve in this book is I noticed people were talking past one another, especially when it came to religion. But it happens in all fields, politics most notably of late, and especially with your guys' election coming up. But with religion, I noticed this with the new atheists, you know, with the already mentioned Harris, for example, which I adore, one of my favorite intellectuals. But you know, the way he spoke about religion, to overuse a term, strawmanning, would describe it quite well. And then when you came to the side of the very intelligent Christian thinkers of today, of John Lennox, an Oxford mathematician, Francis Collins, director of the Human Genome Project, and more, of course, Ravi Zacharias, very intelligent, William Lane Craig, very intelligent people. You have that, you know, this kind of misrepresentation of what is really going on. And, you know, science, the cognitive psychologists have been showing us that research on motivated reasoning and confirmation bias, you know, things that people should know, and people actually, I think, relatively are aware of. But then when they come into contact with opposing views, they don't really put the knowledge they have into effect. So you have people like Harris, you know, who's completely aware. He's I think friendly with Daniel Kahneman, a behavioral economist winning the Nobel Prize in economics in 2002 for his work on fast and slow thinking, system A, system B thinking, I think is what he calls it. Specifically, you know, this is on confirmation bias, and yet, even despite being so close to someone like Kahneman, he will misrepresent and misunderstand the true relationship religion has to society, or even the reasons people are religious in the first place. Which often, you know, are we really responsible for those inclinations? I don't know if we are. I think research suggests that, you know, our biases are quite entrenched and that it's really difficult to know, you know, if our views are, you know, some result of genetics or upbringing, which roughly they're half and half, I've heard. So, but with my book, I chose to write, and with that in mind, I chose to write knowing that people misrepresent and they don't take this into consideration. And so I chose to divide the book into for and against arguments. So the first chapter, Christianity and the Age of Unreason, which Susan Jacoby, an incredible writer, spoke of, and then kind of represent the argument for Christians dealing with the Age of Unreason, you know, have this mass society believing in fake news and misrepresenting and being quite uneducated. What is that phenomenon? Is it a problem? And you know, do Christians have a really good answer for it? And can Christians urge people to reason well and use evidence and arguments and reason and logic? And are there limits to reasoning, which I believe there are crucial limits to reasoning. And so, but I represent that argument and I propose the strongest argument. This is something that Donald Davidson, an American philosopher, proposed infamously. John Stuart Mill talked about it, and others have talked about it. It is the way John Stuart Mill said in On Liberty that we are to represent the argument of the opposition in the best possible way, and then deal with it, you know, and see whether they agree in a way that the opposition would agree with. And so that's something I hoped to do in my book. And, you know, it's up to my Christian friends now, which I have quite a lot of, you know, to give me feedback on. But thus far, it's been pretty positive. And even in writing the book, I made sure to send manuscripts, rough drafts of the manuscript to people who are learning about these things, or people who are have been Christians for most of their lives and are more intellectually minded.
Yeah, and I love your project, and if I could, You know, I relate to it myself, and I think everybody relates to it if they're interested in taking a look at these larger questions. You relate to it in your own way. And, you know, I've been thinking about these questions for a long time. I've studied, you know, philosophy at the University of Rhode Island and then master's in philosophy at Marquette University. But, you know, I've been away from the academic setting, you know, more or less for about 20 years after teaching philosophy at the University of Rhode Island for a year. Now, one of the things that I really like about the questions that you bring up is because, you know, I think about the conflicts that people have, and, you know, I think some of those are theoretical, right? And I think some of those are behavioral, right? And both of these things interact. And so on the theoretical, you kind of lay out, you know, the kind of the general conflict and thought around that. One story that always really, really hit me around discussions, theological or large metaphysical discussions, was there was this group of Buddhists and a group of Christians, and the kind of the more heady intellectual types had been arguing, you know, about, you know, is there one God, right? And in the Christianity, there'd be, you know, a monotheistic God. And in Buddhism, there's like, well, there's no self, no ego, ultimately no sin, no other entity, you know, beyond humans. And all this debate's going on. And meanwhile, the practitioners of the faith, in this case, they're a monastery, Christians and Buddhists, started to compare their day. And they're like, well, what do you do in the morning? Well, we check on the bees. And what do you do after that? Well, we prepare some breakfast and then we take a walk. And they compared their days and they were the same. their schedule is the same. It didn't matter. So that always like intrigued me so deeply, because I had found myself so entrenched on the intellectual or the ideological metaphysical opposition, and then some of the practitioners of the faith saying, well, not a whole lot separating my day from yours. And obviously that's not a solution, but a very intriguing thought, and in kind of a way that I tried to see, how can you bridge the differences? How different are we when we go about the day? And some of us are going to be very different, right? But there might be more overlap than we'll admit intellectually or behaviorally.
Yeah. No, actually, that's a really good point. I mean, I personally, one of the reasons why I dislike my own field of philosophy, your field, is because we do get bogged down in these metaphysical, ontological, epistemological questions when really you look outside and you just see people finding ways to behave morally, you know, and finding ways to be decent to one another without even knowing what utilitarianism, deontology, or the virtue ethics are. And you have that within religion. And, you know, as you said, that's a really good example with Buddhist monks and, you know, the various different Eastern religions. And you had it 2000 years ago with the pre-Socratics and the Socratics and the all these various different schools of thought. And so, yeah, I think that is there's large research. Eric Schwitzgebel, I think his name is, actually showed that moral philosophers are not more likely, with a number of studies, he showed that they're not more likely to clean after themselves after conferences, respond to emails to students, and a number of other than other professors. And they're not more like other philosophy professors, and they're not more likely to do it than other professors in general. So the moral philosophers are not behaving better than philosophers, which could have been okay, I guess, because they're also introduced to moral philosophy, but they're not even better behaved than physicists and, you know, biologists, who have basically no, except maybe for some electives early on in their undergraduate degrees, you know, they didn't really have access to moral philosophy, at least not in the academic setting. So that is also interesting stuff. Yeah. But yeah, that's a good point.
Well, yeah, and I think I really enjoyed and really latched on to what you had said as far as I think it might have come out of Mill of presenting the argument and presenting in a way that is fair, that uses common or proper terms to calibrate and to show what you're saying. The other argument that we see many of the times is, of course, you portray your opponent's argument in the most silliest of fashions and the most ridiculous, and then just wipe it right out of the way, and people using kind of ad hominem attacks to attack saying what. And you get right after this too, and it's part of one of the questions we had talked about, Jacob. You're talking, Christianity and atheism in this battle, or the way that we think about it, kind of maybe the theoretical conflict in a very, we think of 21st century, we think of the year 2020 and various fractures that can be observed around the world and stresses due to a pandemic. But the age-old question sits back. I think in your study and back behind your thoughts is the question of morality that you just brought up, or how people behave. And the common criticism of atheism is what is the moral framework? How do we evaluate behavior without a larger arbiter or standard? And I know you have some thoughts on that. Do you want to talk about atheists? Can they be moral in morality?
Yeah, it's one of the more common questions atheists get, because that is, I mean, I remember when I turned to atheism, 1920, and that was my first thought, was among my first thoughts that I remember is like, okay, so what can I get to do now? And what do I do? There was kind of this ambivalence or the unknown. But with morality, I think atheists have as good a job, if not better, at providing a consolable moral world. So first of all, much of our moral understanding has to do with our genes and, kin altruism early on, developing in hunter-gatherer societies. And you see this not only with early, Homo sapiens, etc. You see it with other species, non-human animals as well. You see cooperation in species that are separate from our animal tree. Elephants and dolphins, who have completely developed separately from us, and they have no evolutionary lineage to us. And so kin altruism is a perfectly relevant standard to translate or to look at it, to see whether there is any moral understanding. And we see that there is some morality, and you see it in animals. Of course, it's not as developed because of cognitive capabilities that are completely different, and linguistic capabilities, and we've developed culture and society and writing, and this really helped us, in providing, kind of expanding on one another. And I talked about that in my book, that the development of writing in ancient civilizations helped people critique and expand and develop early texts on morality, basic eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of morality. But that later on developed into human rights and people wanting to have some fairness in society, not being taxed inappropriately. And eventually that led to, revolutions and the French Revolution. David Hume talking against absolutist monarchy and people declaring independence from monarchs, as Americans had. Yeah. And so the origins were, of course, weak, and it took us forever to develop kind of a strict moral sense. But the kind of basic morality we have entrenched within us from early kin stages. And so I don't think that, and that is something that is just, it's not a matter of, Timothy Keller talks about this in Making Sense of God, his book, that we atheists have this arbitrary morality. No, we have as good of a morality as the Christians have. And furthermore, there's also just problems within the Christian narrative of what exactly the morality is. You know, is it really something that they're getting from the Bible, or is it something they're getting societally? And I think that the evidence is really for the latter case, that societally they're much more prone to be less critical of for example, gay rights or trans rights, even, you know, of late, apart from fundamentalists. But in the 1600s, you wouldn't have that. You would have, you know, the morality of Aquinas, Augustine, Luther, and Calvin are complete contradictions to what we think of as moral today. So, you know, together with other authors, I ask, you know, where is this transcendental metaphysical reality morality that, you know, Christians speak of? And I can't see it, you know. So within that question that the Christians ask atheists, you know, how can you guys be moral? Really, they're supposing that they've been moral for two millennia. And if you look at the historical records, you know, Christians were not really acting in any morally significant way. If anything, in the Hellenic world of Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato, you'd have a lot of schools developing that were just really stressing moral conduct and virtuous lives. You know, people thinking that that was pretty much all there was to life. Aristotle saying that that is the happiest life, and, you know, Plato stressing that only the rational should rule, for example, which today we think of as anti-democratic. But so I think that we really do have a good sense of morality, and primarily that is because of genes, but then also social obligations, laws, customs. These things have changed through the centuries, and, you know, a lot of our morality comes from the 1960s, from the rights revolution. You know, pre-rights revolution, women often were still considered inferior, and obviously there were ethnic problems with a lot of states were experiencing. And today we still do not have a developed kind of moral sense. A lot of us, you know, a lot of people aren't sensitive to racial issues, for example. A lot of people aren't even sensitive to domestic abuse problems in the world. Russia, for example, not having laws against it within marriage. So I don't think we have a developed sense of morality. We're still figuring it out. But we do have the guilt, and we have the social ostracization, and those are perfectly good, reasonable ramifications for immoral behavior. And, you know, so everyone has that. I mean, if you do not have sociopathic tendencies, you do have just something within you. And then Christians, of course, can talk about conscience and where that's implanted from. But I think Patricia Churchland has perfectly explained in her book Conscience, and others have done this as well, that really everything, I think Patricia Churchland said this, that it all comes down to caring and bonding and early bonding. Yeah, so I think that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah, and I appreciate you mentioning that. I mean, I think there's a bounty of areas to explore about how human beings, you know, on a basic level can cohabitate, act morally, and or what the basis is for that. And certainly the ethics of care is one. And I also think underneath the things that you're saying, I heard a lot of this because I've studied kind of the role of shame and guilt, right? And, you know, the general idea of guilt being more internally driven, shame when you're looking at a more public setting and where that would work to modify behavior one way or another, not talking about the quality or why or whether that behavior should be modified, but they're powerful drivers societally. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right in saying that, you know, an atheist is not operating outside of the context of the conditions in the world that they live in, right?
Yeah,
it isn't like let me import the manual of behavior from outside of all this. It's inside because you're still in those parameters. And I think there's a lot of fertile ground and some good indications that you give of places of where to look, you know, of where to look and where to think about morality for, you know, an atheist morality or a modern morality, and having those discussions. Jacob, I wanted to ask you a little bit, just to make sure I got it, as far as with your connection with music. You want to lay that out a little bit more, as far as you mentioned a few instruments that you played in other projects, as far as your expression.
As being raised as a Christian, you know, you're exposed to music, and you know, every church needs a bass player, needs a guitarist, needs a drummer, or any other musician. So yeah, we were exposed to music, and I was taught how to play basic chords on bass, and you know, that developed into me really wanting to learn how to play on drums, and me and some close friends would just play on drums ad infinitum, you know, on the weekends at our church, and that was really great. And then I just got more inclined to pursue guitar, and I was really influenced by John Mayer, you know, his acoustic stuff, and you know, Ben Howard and others. And recently I recorded last year, and I've been wanting to record here in Slovakia while I'm here. And so I will be releasing something on Spotify under a name I do not know yet, so I can't, but it would probably be something like my name. But I would want to have music officially on Spotify, and it would probably just be acoustic, no singing, just kind of layered acoustic music with some background stuff on, kind of like study music even, or just kind of thinking, meditative music. Yeah,
thank you for that, Jacob. And I think one of the things that I try to do, and the reason why I asked again for a little bit more on the program, is you know, looking at your creative endeavors, obviously writing a book, mm-hmm. getting into these very difficult, heady questions is one thing, but you know, I find a lot of times we're up to a lot of different things as far as creating, you know, creating things. And I really appreciate your additional and look forward and, you know, to seeing you get to your goal of releasing music.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Very, very much so. Jacob, why is there something rather than nothing?
Yeah. So this it's a loaded question. I think that, well, first of all, I think that philosophers have been too preoccupied with this question. And I think that, you know, arguments from causation, I'll read them dozens of times and I still don't understand really what Aristotle is saying. And so, yeah, but, you know, so that's my understanding of this question, is that up until John Locke and Newton, all of the discussion about the question for why is there something rather than nothing was pretty much pointless. The epistemic ideal, you know, of Plato and Aristotle, of focusing on the primary cause, was kind of a waste of time, I would say. And I think that philosophers would crucify me for this, especially, you know, in metaphysics and all these.
Very legitimate. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Well, as someone, you're from metaphysics, your background. I mean, I will read these explanations, and I really don't understand how they have any bearing on the world. But I mean, that is also kudos to them for their intelligence and really getting at why. But then the problem with those explanations, I think, is that, and John Locke kind of talked about this, and Newton talked about this, and Galileo specifically, you know, scientists, they were saying that we needn't know the primary cause. We don't have to know, you know, the things that are, to them, they explained it as the unexplainable. We need to explain basic natural phenomena. And so with this question, I look to evidence of basic natural phenomena. And, you know, some scientists have been talking about empty space, and really that there wasn't such a thing as complete nothingness, that there was something. And I think that, you know, maybe I, for myself, as not a trained scientist, and I only dabble in the popular science, I don't even look at the scientific literature, I find that a completely justifiable position. I don't really know why there has to be nothing, strictly speaking, as a no thing. I can imagine all sorts of, different, a type of matter or a type of empty space, which isn't really nothing from my understanding of it. It's atoms and it's some sort of antimatter or dark energy or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So that would be kind of my explanation, is that I don't think we need a primary cause. I don't think we need, and then also you're really quickly jumping into the God of the Gaps argument if you jump to monotheism, and you're jumping into all sorts of conclusions. I don't think that there's any satisfactory position for someone who is a, strict logician. There's no logical explanation. I think that even, well, physicists will disagree about this ad infinitum. You'll have physicists who say that there's no possibility of this happening, and you'll have physicists like Lawrence Krauss saying that it's completely reasonable. And for myself as a layperson, it's really difficult to make sense of it. And I don't know if we really need, and that's kind of my own quote unquote philosophy of science, is that, a lot of our scientific explanations, we don't have the answers, at least as lay people. Other people have the answers, and we have more a collective intelligence versus an individualistic intelligence. Individually, we really don't know that much, but collectively, when we get together, we come up with solutions. And with my personal life, this question particularly, it doesn't really keep me up at night, because I really do explain, I explain it as, I don't really know if there had to be nothing. And I don't know if that, I really haven't even come across that position. It's almost like the same argument as we were talking earlier about morality. People propose a binary position between objective and relativistic morality, as if it's only the two,
Right,
that
right.
either we have objective or no. And I think that is the same with the nothing or something. It's like, well, maybe there was something all the time. Why do we have to have a primary cause? So that's kind of briefly my position.
Well, no, and I appreciate that too. I found that as a backdrop and prompt around creativity, but of course, the large metaphysical question, I've been very influenced by the science that I've studied and read, showing that the way that this question and other questions are framed, might just be outmoded, right? It might just be outmoted on the something and nothing, and reframed maybe Krauss or others in that circle, as I mentioned before, saying, why is there something, right? Like, move away from the nothingness, and kind of get away from larger questions that there needed to be, the void, and pointing to the void as an kind of outmoded concept, pre-scientific almost. So definitely a lot of ways to engage around this question, and I appreciate your thoughts. Jacob, I want to there's plenty for us to talk about. I assume this is probably the first time that we'll chat on the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. But prior to us departing, I wanted to give you the opportunity. I'd love for folks to be able to come into contact, whatever hints you can give around, whether it's your writing, music, you mentioned some of your blog posts, anything related to that that you want to share with listeners, just as far as to, kind of come in contact with you and maybe, these debates.
Well, my book is on Amazon, and I guess I have an Instagram devoted to my guitar, and I have an Instagram that's much more active devoted to kind of travel and book reviews. So I published around 200 book reviews on that Instagram account, and now I just primarily focus on kind of travel stuff. So I'm a kind of a history nerd, and so I like to post about some historical stuff going on in Europe and even in the West. And so if people want to get in touch, that's jacob.forensic.official, and it's JAKUB dot FERENCIK. And I guess there's going to be links of some sort, or it's going to be written down somewhere. But yeah, so that's kind of primarily, and my blog is on Medium, and that's mainly on philosophy, religion, and politics. I'm actually strongly in the about to switch to a political science major. So it's something that I've really been more in tune with. And even for my master's, I'm strongly considering continuing with political science. And so, yeah, 300 plus blog posts there. And apart from that, it's just the average Twitter and Facebook stuff.
Yeah. Well, and thanks for sharing that too. I'm looking forward to taking a look at, you know, your book reviews. I love to read the book reviews as a way of coming into contact with some of the thoughts that are out there and seeing how intellectuals engage them. Look forward to that. But I wanted to thank you, Jacob. I've really enjoyed, you know, coming in contact with your work. And like I said, there's obviously a ton of stuff to develop from our conversation and talk about further. I hope we have that opportunity, but I just wanted to thank you for your time, because some great bigger philosophical questions and discussions that the show gets into, although it's a philosophy and art podcast. And I just wanted to thank you for your contribution to the show.
No, thank you so much for having me. I mean, it's been a real pleasure, and even the questions have been amazing. And yeah, I hope to be back.
All right. Thank you so much, Jacob, and hope to talk to you again very soon.